Yeah, I'm excited to tell you a bit about, like Cliff said, some current research that's going on about superradiance and black holes. So I'm going to start out with a bit of background first to get everyone on the same page. So the title of the talk, as assigned, is Superradiance and Black Holes. My slightly more exciting version is How to Extract Energy from a Black Hole and Discover New Particles. So first, I will start by telling you about what is superradiance. And superradiance is a very general process, which is the extraction of an object's rotational energy by an incident wave in the presence of dissipation. And the interesting thing is that Kerr black holes just like are rotating objects, and they can also superradiate. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And they can lose energy and angular momentum in this process to incident bosonic fields. Then I'll talk about these systems that I'll call, as a cartoon, gravitational atoms, which are going to be light scalar or other bosonic fields that can create bound states with astrophysical black holes. And I'll describe the properties of those bound states. And it turns out that those bound states have the ability to grow exponentially through the superradiance process. And finally, I'll at the end, I'll switch to some slides to tell you about the signatures of this kinds of processes, which is that if there's a new light particle in the theory beyond the standard model, such as some of the ones you've heard about in your earlier lectures, this can be a way to detect these new particles. In particular, it's very effective if the Compton wavelength of the new particle is comparable to the size of astrophysical stellar mass black holes. And you can also see the effects in gravitational waves and LIGO, which you'll hear about more next week. OK, so let's get started. And feel free to interrupt me with questions. I want to make sure everyone's following along. OK, so first, let's talk about a cartoon example, just Newtonian mechanics. Okay, so we have superradiance kinematically, let's say. So normally, you think if you have some sort of source of dissipation or friction, your system will tend to lose energy. For example, if you have an ingoing ball that's sliding along a frictional surface, the velocity at the end will be smaller than the initial velocity. So that all makes sense. But the interesting thing is that once you start things rotating, you can get some counterintuitive effects, or what appears to be counterintuitive effects. So let's, instead of a flat surface, let's take a cylinder. And let's say the cylinder has the same frictionful surface around it. And let's just keep the cylinder at rest for a second. And let's have this ball tangentially graze the cylinder. So here it's the same exact picture as above. The ball will slow down as it comes in contact with the cylinder because of the friction between them. So the final velocity of the ball will be less than the initial velocity. In particular, let's consider the phase velocity, so the change in its angular velocity with respect to the center of the cylinder. OK, let's see what happens when we start rotating the cylinder at some frequency omega cylinder. So this is some angular frequency. If we rotate it quickly enough so that the angular frequency of the cylinder is equal to the initial phase velocity of the ball, then what happens is that as they come in contact, they're moving at exactly the same velocity. So there's no relative velocity and no friction. And therefore, in this case, the final velocity, the final phase velocity will be equal to the initial phase velocity. As we speed up the cylinder still further, so it's rotating even faster, now we have the cylinder angular velocity is faster than the initial phase velocity. So what happens is that the cylinder is rotating, the ball, and the ball passes through, it actually gets a kick from the cylinder so that the final velocity is actually bigger than the initial velocity. And you can understand this by a bit better by switching frames. So if we now go to the instantaneously stationary frame of the cylinder, where the cylinder is at rest, then if it's rotating fast enough, that means the ball's actually coming at it as it's rotating, right? Because if in the lab frame, the cylinder is rotating faster than the ball, then we can go in some frame where the ball is actually traveling in the opposite direction to the cylinder. And then that means that as the friction acts, it's pushing the velocity to slow down in the backwards direction, which means that in the lab frame, it's actually speeding up. So this is just the same statement as I made here, but you can see how by switching frames, dissipation is actually has a funny property of sometimes being able to act as an energy source instead of an energy sink. And notice here that what we're really interested in is comparing the velocities at the point of contact, or the rotational velocity of the cylinder to the rotational velocity of the ball. And so this will come back again several times, and it's actually equivalent to what's known as the superradiance condition, is that you can extract energy from rotating objects if their rotational velocity is faster than the angular velocity of the incident wave or particle. So that, and we can also immediately try to generalize it. So let's say now we have for a field instead of a particle, let's say we have a scalar field. It's a function of RT and theta. I apologize, and phi, I apologize, I'll be using phi both for the field and for the angle. So if there's any confusion, let me know. So we have this scalar field, and let's say it has some R dependence, and it's just a free scalar field with which you can decompose as solutions that are plane waves and angular with some angular dependence. So in this case, what's the phase velocity of this field? It's d phi dt, which is we just take the derivative of the field with respect to t and divide it by the derivative of the field with respect to phi. So this gives us omega over m. And so it'll turn out that for waves, the superradiance condition is that the rotational velocity of your cylinder or other object has to be faster than the energy of the particle divided by the angular momentum number m. And here I'll be using little m as exclusively the angular momentum quantum number, which for instance is the thing that characterizes how many, if you have a wave function in a circle, it characterizes how many modes are around in the circle. When I talk about masses of particles, I'll use mu to avoid confusion. Okay, so this will be, so this is just a guess, translating this intuition from phase velocity here to phase velocity of a field. Let's try to go through a more explicit example, which is due to, as far as I know, originally Zeldovich, who did a lot of work on these, on superradiance in general. So now let's think about this frame dependence more carefully. And we can even do it, so I've been talking about rotational superradiance, but we can even start with an example which you can see this effect in linear motion. So let's keep our same phi field. There, the phi field was a solution to just the massless Klein-Gordon equation. But now let's say instead, where's the eraser? We add in a loss term, which is very similar to your intuition from what friction does. There's some parameter times a time derivative of the field. So this is something that's now introduces dependence on the direction of time, and it'll actually lead to loss in the amplitude of this field over time. So if we solve this equation, you can consider, let's say, this alpha parameter small. So if alpha is 0, the solution is of the form e to the minus I omega t plus ikx, plane waves, right? And with this alpha parameter, what you find is that there's also a loss. Power that's given by some gamma, which depends on this coefficient. So in particular, if we plug in this ansatz, you'll find that the solution is when gamma is just equal to alpha. Is everyone on board with me here? Okay, so let's say this scalar wave is traveling to some medium and has some dissipation, and then it'll generally be lossy. But what happens if now there's some, we switch to a different frame, say the lab frame, which is moving with respect to the medium? In that case, if the two frames are moving with respect to each other at velocity v, then to describe the motion in that frame, you'll want to redefine your variables and your derivatives. And your time will now become time plus a spatial derivative. You can also shift all of the other things, but that just comes out as an overall factor. So here, what we get is a new equation of motion for phi, dt plus v dx phi equals 0. So let's go through this a bit more carefully. We plug in a similar plane wave solution. So this just comes out plus ikx omega squared minus k squared on phi plus alpha minus I omega, which was the same thing that we had before, plus v I k from this part of the exponent. The thing that's leading to your loss in this equation is actually going to there's actually a relative sign here. So let's rearrange it again. The full equation now becomes, let's see. Box phi naught minus I omega alpha times 1 minus V k over omega on phi naught equals 0. So now, this previously was the thing that gave you a decaying exponential in your scalar field. But now you see that if the relative velocity is large compared to k over omega, then this decay can actually switch sign and become a growth. So now can you guys see down here? Now our gamma is no longer just alpha, it's alpha times 1 minus vk over omega, which can be less than 0 if v is bigger than k over omega, which technically means that the medium is traveling faster than the speed of light of the field. So this is kind of reminiscent of something that looks like a bit of Cherenkov radiation. Yes?
Is it the flip?
Yes, thanks. Here?
Yeah,
thank you.
What happened to the alpha when you pulled it out? When you factorized the alpha?
Oh, the alpha is on top of, it's on both. So the rate, this is actually very important, is that the overall rate is still going to be proportional to this alpha, which is the kind of loss coefficient.
Because this is what you compare to the...
Exactly, but the... But the.
But in the equation, two lines above that, you had alpha times minus I omega plus...
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks. Yes, please let me know if I'm sloppy on the board. Okay. Yeah, so this is... So the overall loss is still proportional. The overall growth or decay is proportional to the loss coefficient, but the sign can change depending on the relative motion. And the same thing will happen for rotation. And I'll basically, instead of taking a linear transformation, let's go to a frame that's rotating. So instantaneously, we can take dt as going to dt plus omega d phi, where omega is some rotation of a medium. And here, basically, you can work through the same math. And at a given point, you can just substitute x is r times the radius times the angular coordinate, and v is omega times the size of your rotating absorbing cylinder. And so this is the transformation that you get. And going through the same math, now now we want a different form of the scalar field. We want something that satisfies the symmetries of this problem. So let's take phi of t, and little phi is going to be proportional to some phi 0 e to the minus I omega t plus I m phi. And the same logic gives you, we apply the box and the derivative operators. So with this coordinate shift, so now we get box phi 0 minus I omega alpha 1. But now we want a, let's put this, let's keep this derivative, d phi over omega, because I've pulled the omega out here already, on phi. So d phi on phi is m, so we get, or minus I m. Okay, let me not be too sloppy. Let me just put it in right away. Okay, like this. So I'm hitting this function with this time derivative, which pulls down in minus I omega, and the omega d phi, which pulls down an omega I omega m. So now you get this new expression, which again gives you solutions of the form phi is e to the minus I omega t plus I m phi minus gamma, where gamma is alpha is equal to gamma t, excuse me, times this factor. And that's exactly the same relation that we had over there. So here, the growth or decay of the field will switch sign if you have, if the rotation of your medium is faster than the phase velocity. And that makes slightly more sense than traveling faster than the speed of light, although that's also possible if you have some medium with different effective velocity. Because phase velocity can very easily be slow, even for massless particles, right? You can have even zero phase velocity if you have some scalar, some spherical wave radiation for light, for example. Okay, so this is super radiance for scalar fields for cylinders, and it was also done in more detail. When I post my talk, I guess I'll put some references up at the end for you if you guys want to take a look. So there's some nice papers on calculating super radiance for rotating conducting cylinder, where you have a rotating cylinder with some resistivity. So it dissipates a current and you send some electromagnetic radiation, and that electromagnetic radiation will in general be absorbed, so the amplitude of the wave will decrease as the light passes through. But as you increase the rotation speed of the cylinder, it can actually amplify the light waves. And it's exactly the same condition. And the nice thing here, which is not obvious from the kinetic ball analogy, is that with fields, what happens is that the amplitude of the field increases. So the way that you extract energy from the cylinder, and I should say, or from the medium, obviously this energy has to eventually come from somewhere, and it comes from slowing down the rotation. And the way that you extract the energy is by increasing the amplitude of this bosonic field, whereas there you actually just increase the velocity of the ball. So here you can see that it's the amplitude of the field that's growing through this exponential behavior. Okay, so now that we have the cartoon example, what is the fastest dissipators and fastest rotators that we know of in the universe? As you can see, the rate of growth or dissipation is proportional to this coefficient. So if you want really fast growth, you want actually something that dissipates extremely efficiently. And you want something that rotates very quickly, because then you can access more of the modes of the field and satisfy this irradiance condition. So the fastest things and the fastest dissipators and fastest rotators we know are black holes. So let's talk a little bit about black holes.
So just speaking, I understand, why is it a fast dissipator?
Because anything you throw into the black hole will go into the black hole. It's as simple as that. So normally if you have, if you shoot light at a table, it'll get absorbed, you know, after some thickness of the table, which is usually very small. But if you shoot axions, for example, at the table, they'll just pass through basically 100% of the time. Whereas whatever particle you shoot at a black hole, it's going to get absorbed into the black hole. Yeah. Good. So I want to, so in terms of black holes, I want to tell you a few facts, and I'll do a bit of math on the board as time allows. But sometimes you might have to take my word for it. Actually, let me write this here so that we can keep it up. So I'm not sure how much or GR you've seen or how recently you've had it. So most of the statements I'll make, there'll be conclusions that you can take if you haven't seen this in detail. But let me know if you have questions. So we want to consider a Kerr black hole, which is the solution for a rotating black hole. And that's one that was found much later than the previous solutions, which was the Schwarzschild, which is the completely spherical symmetric one, and also the charged black hole. So it's, and once I write down the metric, you'll see that it's not surprising that it took a while for Kerr to find the solution. It's a bit messy. So let's look at the line element here. And I'll define all these things in a second. And while I'm writing this, do you guys have any questions on the general superradiance idea? No? I think I'm missing something. Oh yes, the important thing. So I've defined a few new parameters here. I've defined a few new parameters here. One of them is RG, which is the gravitational radius of the black hole. The other one is A, which characterizes how quickly the black hole is rotating. And so let me write these for you here. So these will be the important things in terms of when we go to the phenomenological signatures. So RG is G Newton times the mass of the black hole. And that basically tells you the light crossing time that it takes to go across the equivalent horizon size of the black hole. that's rotating quickly. Then we have A, which is the angular momentum per unit mass of the black hole. And also define this as a dimensionless quantity A star times RG. So A star, an absolute value, goes from, can be zero for a Schwarzschild black hole, and it goes up to one. So you can see here, if you set A to zero in all of these terms, what you'll get out in the end is the Schwarzschild metric. And I'm going to define sigma and delta in a second. Yes?
So the very last thing in your metric, should it be dt, d phi?
Yes, thanks. You guys are paying attention. This is good. Excellent. OK, so sigma and delta both have dimensions of r squared. Sigma is r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta. And delta is r squared minus 2rg r plus a squared. So this just goes to r squared in the Schwarzschild limit. And this goes to r squared minus 2rg r, which kind of looks like the Schwarzschild metric coefficients. Okay, so that's the metric, and it's nice because it's independent of t and phi, so it still has some symmetries to work with, but it's definitely getting more complicated. So first, I want to tell you about the event horizon. As you probably know, black holes have event horizons, which you can define rigorously in many, you can define rigorously in different ways, but I'll just skip a bit and say, you may remember from the Schwarzschild solution, it was when this metric coefficient blew up, or alternatively, this delta went to zero. So that's when, basically, at the point, this is the hypersurface in radius beyond which there are no paths that can increase in R. So all of the paths will eventually hit the singularity at the center of the black hole. And you can find that by setting this GRR. So this component here is the GRR lower component of the metric. You can set the inverse of that to zero and solve. So this is delta over sigma, which is r squared minus 2rgr plus a squared over some positive number. So this is a quadratic equation for r. So we find r event horizon will have two roots, which is rg times 1 plus or minus square root of 1 minus a star squared. And you can see, if you set, whereas a star is, again, this dimensionless number, which characterizes how quickly the black hole is spinning. And you can see that this just goes to 2rg for a star 0, which is consistent with what you might remember from Schwarzschild black holes, where the radius is at 2g, where the horizon is at 2gm. And it goes to rg, so it actually gets smaller for maximally spinning black hole. So this is 0, and this is 1. OK. So this is the event horizon. Then unlike Schwarzschild black holes.
Those limits for R plus, I guess, is that right?
Yes, thank you. So yeah, so there's a outer and an inner event horizon. Practically, we are only going to care about the outer horizon, because if our observer is outside of the black hole, once you go into the outer event horizon, that's you can't escape from the black hole. There's other interesting GR phenomena that we can, well, we might be able to explore if we get more inside the black hole, but I'm not going to go there. So yeah, we'll just focus on R plus. Thanks. Good. So unlike Schwarzschild black holes, Kerr black holes have another interesting surface, which is not the event horizon, but it's called the stationary limit surface, or the ergo region surface. Oops. And that's where the sign of the t component of the metric switches sign. And so let's calculate when that happens, and then we'll discuss what effects that has. So GTT is zero, which means sigma so I'm just rewriting that top thing. So it's sigma minus 2R RG over sigma equals zero. And again, this is a quadratic equation, which gives us the ergo region radius, which is RG times 1 plus or minus 1 minus A star squared cosine squared theta. So again, there'll be an outer and an inner ergo region. Okay, and let's see what this looks like. I'm gonna attempt to draw a circle, so bear with me. Okay, so we have a black hole, that's a circle. And then outside, there's an ergo region, it's supposed to be symmetrical, where this is the outer ergo region, RG 1 plus 1 minus A star squared cos squared theta. And the inside is the event horizon, okay. So you can see that when theta is when theta is zero, these two should be touching because cosine theta is one. And then when theta is pi over two, this extends further out. So there's a region in between the ergo region and the event horizon. Yes.
So can you bring that board down? Just wondering what's.
Oh, the top one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can try. How far can you see? Can you see like this?
What's it divided by? Like, if delta over epsilon equals.
Sorry, which.
I'm just
right hand side, left hand side.
Oh, it's a pop.
Oh, they're all sigmas. Sorry, so here it says sigma minus two R G over sigma.
Yeah. Okay. No.
You got it. Okay. Yes. Okay. Cool. So the interesting thing about this region in the ergo region is the interesting thing about the region between the stationary limit surface and the horizon is that that's where even light has to rotate. And we'll see that here we can derive what we think of as the angular velocity of the black hole, which is what we'll need for the superradiance condition. Yes.
Is it true for any black hole that the ergo region can't go inside the event horizon?
I think so. I mean, I've imposed this condition on A star, which if A star becomes one or bigger than one, you get funny things like naked singularities. So I don't really know what happens there, but those are not really black holes. I don't know, maybe you know. If the ergo region never goes inside the event horizon, I don't think so. There's also an inner ergo region and an inner event horizon, but we're not gonna worry about that.
Yeah, because I think you have, well, the idea is that you have to be able to rotate without falling in, but if you're inside, you're gonna be falling. You're gonna be falling in,
yeah.
So you can't.
Yeah.
You can't stay at fixed star anywhere as a neighborhood. You can't stay at fixed star as long as you rotate.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so by the definitions I've given, that definitely doesn't happen. I don't know if you can think of some other examples. Okay, so let's see what happens. So let's think about shooting light rays in the ergo region, okay? So let's take, now this is a side view, so the black hole is rotating this way. Let's take a top view. So it's rotating this way. Can everyone see over here? Yeah, okay. I'll move around so hopefully everyone can see. So let's think about a photon, which is, so this is the horizon and this is the ergosphere. Let's take a photon that at one instant only has velocity in the phi direction, so along the rotation or opposite to the rotation of the black hole. And then we can calculate what its instantaneous phase velocity has to be. So this we can do by looking at null trajectories, which have ds squared equals zero. Since light travels at the speed of light, it has a null trajectory. And this gives gtt. So just to not keep writing all those things over, I'll abbreviate this, gtt t squared plus 2 gt phi dt d phi plus g phi phi d phi squared. So now hopefully you're getting very comfortable with the quadratic formula because we're going to solve it again. So here we can divide through by dt squared, and this becomes a quadratic equation for d phi dt. Plus 2 gt phi phi dot plus g phi 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 dot squared. So this gives d phi dt equal to minus gt phi over g phi phi plus or minus square root of the same thing squared minus gt t over g phi phi. Okay. I apologize if you have trouble reading the subscripts. Let me know. So remember, we've defined the ergo region where the t component, the tt component of the metric goes through zero. So we can make an interesting statement there, which is what are the velocities of the light rays inside or right at the ergo surface? So we can set gtt to zero. So there's two solutions. This minus this is zero. So we have zero, or we have twice this first term, which is minus gt phi over g phi phi. And if you look up there, gt phi is negative, and g phi phi is positive. So this is always positive. So this means that even if you shoot a light ray in some arbitrary direction, at the very best, it doesn't have any phi velocity. And at the worst, it's traveling along in the same direction as the black hole. In particular, also if you solve for things which don't have null trajectories but have time-like trajectories, so they're particles which have a mass, they'll always have to co-rotate with the black hole inside the ergo region. So this is at r equals r ergo region. In the interest of time, I won't go through the algebra, but you can also do this at the horizon. Okay, so at the horizon, you can solve for the phi velocity, the phase velocity, excuse me, at r equals r plus. You just plug in the same equation, but now you evaluate at r plus. So let me just write down the final answer for that. So the fun thing that happens there is that there's only one solution, and what you get is the angular velocity, what we'll define as the angular velocity of the black hole is going to be given by omega, which is d phi dt at r equals r plus, which is a star 1 over 2 RG A star over 1 plus 1 minus A star squared. So we can again take some limits. This is nice because when A star goes to 0, this goes to 0. So that's good. Nothing's rotating in the Schwarzschild metric. And when A star approaches 1, this approaches 1 over 2 RG. So you have something which has phase velocity of order 1 over 2 rg at radii, which are of order rg. So things are traveling of order 1 of the speed of light. And everything is co-rotating with the black hole. Yes?
Is the denominator like brackets around?
Yeah, I meant to write this as two fractions, and then it got messy. Yes, thanks. There we go. OK, so now we know what the angular velocity of the black hole is. Or alternatively, the angular velocity of all the things close to the horizon. Any questions on Kerr black hole facts and algebra? Okay.
Is there an interesting thing that happens if you set the other components to zero? So like G phi pi or something like that?
I don't think so. I mean, some of them just do similar things, like if I mean, these are also, by the way, a particular choice of coordinates in GR. There's a zoo of different coordinates that you can use for different things. So so these ones are nice because they reduce to nice things far away from the black hole and also to the Schwarzschild metric. So these are called the Bayer-Lindquist coordinates. Probably in some other coordinates, you could do things that have funny singularities for the other coordinates, but that would just mean that you probably picked the wrong coordinates because it does have this, at least azimuthal symmetry, so you probably don't want anything that's doing weird in the phi direction. Particularly, I think it would be very strange if something weird was happening in the phi direction, because that's actually a symmetry of the problem. Yeah. But yeah, you can do all sorts of coordinate redefinitions and get interesting things happening. Any other questions? I lost my eraser. Here we go. Okay, so we have talked about general superradiance, and we've talked a little bit about black holes. So now let's spend a bit of time talking about scalar fields around black holes and how they can form bound states. So can you guys still read some of the definitions over there? Okay, so let's talk about what I'll call gravitational atoms. Gravitational. So intuitively, whatever kind of black hole you have far away from the black hole is just a mass, right? If you're many, many Schwarzschild radii away, you don't know if it's a black hole or a sun that's sourcing the gravitational potential. And what it looks like is just a 1 over r potential. And if you have objects like rocks or like scalar fields, they can become bound in that gravitational potential. So let's switch gears a little bit and see what kinds of solutions you can get if you have a scalar field in the black hole background. And for simplicity, I'll just talk about a limiting case where you have scalar fields that are mostly localized far away from the black hole, which if you stare at those equations, you'll see that that lets us drop some of the messy Kerr metric terms, because they generally go as Kerr compared to, say, Schwarzschild, go as A over R, which is dimensionless number times RG over R. So let's ignore them for now. So you'll just have a metric that's a Schwarzschild black hole with a scalar field sitting outside. And what kinds of scalar fields do we care about? Well, the reason why I'm interested in these kinds of problems is similar to some of the motivation you heard from maybe the previous lectures earlier today about axions. So axions are a particular class of pseudoscalar fields, which are well motivated as extensions to beyond the standard model because they solve the strong CP problem. It also turns out they can be the dark matter, but that's not super relevant for this case. And all we're going to care about is a scalar field, which has a kinetic term. And I think in this metric, it's a minus sign and a mass term. As I promised, I'm putting the mass as mu instead of m. So for the axion, you might have seen a cosine potential here. So if we just expand that to leading order, it looks like a mass term. And then you'll have some quartic terms, which are generally small for these axion-like particles. So if we do the equations of motion for this field, we get del mu del nu phi plus mu squared phi equals 0, which normally would give us something like plane wave solutions with a massive relationship between the energy and the momentum. But now we have these covariant derivatives here, which know all about the fact that there's a black hole at the center. And I'll start setting up the problem for you, and then I'll skip to the end to spare you some of the algebra. So what we want to do is, first we want to expand these covariant derivatives. So when they act on a scalar, it looks like g mu nu d dx mu d dx mu. So that's just the normal thing with a flat metric. This is just dt squared minus d minus grad squared. And then there's our friends from GR, the Christoffel symbols, which are which tell you about dependencies in the metric of some coordinates on other coordinates. So you get some extra derivative terms, extra single derivative terms because of non-trivial metric dependencies on the coordinates. So if you expand this thing out, what we want to solve for is we want to solve for a scalar field which is non-relativistic. And that's mostly for simplicity. We want to look at scalar fields which have energies that are small compared to their mass. So they're basically at rest and they have small velocity. and so that will allow us to expand some of this. So let me just define our scalar field as, so we have a real scalar field, and we can define it as an expansion like this. With some normalization constant here. So I'm allowed to do this, and I'm picking the kinds of solutions where the psi field is slowly varying with time compared to the mass of the particle. So psi dot over psi is much less than mu. This is a non-relativistic expansion. Relativistic. Okay, excellent. And psi is allowed to be complex, but then the final thing will be a real scalar field. So if anyone is interested, I have all the Christoffel symbols here. but I think I'll skip that, and I'll just tell you what that equation looks like. So let me write down this piece first. So this looks like and let me also define G00 up here to spare me some writing, 2RG over R. So this looks like 1 over G00 dt squared minus G00 dr squared minus 1 over R squared d theta squared. Plus 1 over sine squared theta d phi squared. So this is sort of starting to look nice and familiar in terms of you've seen some solutions to spherical harmonic equations and the angular momentum operator. So this is, it's not quite there yet. So that's the first piece from the G mean U. And then from the other piece, we get also a minus, let's see, Q over R dr minus cosine theta over sine theta d theta. And there's also a minus 2RG over R dr piece. So this is actually kind of interesting because what the Christoffels do for you is give you these linear partial derivatives, which then let you do the full thing, which let you have the full derivative in spherical coordinates. So if we take the limit where RG over R goes to 0, what this becomes is just dt squared minus rad squared, where I've written rad squared in spherical coordinates.
You need the phi in the first line.
I need the phi in the first line. What do you mean?
In everything's acting on phi, right?
This is, oh, yes.
Sorry.
Yes. Excellent.
Last term from here also, we're probably missing one of our non-dimensional
Yes. Yes, thank you. Probably one of our squared, right? Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Which last term?
The RG over RDR.
DR.
Is it over R squared?
Right? Yeah, I guess so. Okay. And probably, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. Okay, yes, good, thanks. Okay, good. So, we don't want to completely take the RG over R goes to zero limit, because then that gets rid of all the interesting effects. But what that actually looks like is, let me write it like this. One, so if I'll expand to leading order, you get dt squared. And then we're also, okay. And let me just keep this term. It'll also have a piece that's proportional to RG over R, but I'm not gonna write it out because I'll end up dropping it later. It'll end up being subdominant. So the piece we're gonna care about is the piece in terms of the dt squared. And then there's some spatial derivative on psi, and this is all equal to zero. On phi, excuse me. Do you want me to do it out in more detail, or are we okay? No?
What's in the small bracket?
Here?
Yeah.
Here is RG over R. So that's my code word for there's actually a few more RG pieces that come in this derivative, but I don't want to write it up.
RG over R is just a constant in this case, right?
No, because RG is a constant, but R is the parameter that the field depends on. R is the spatial R. Yeah, it's a spatial coordinate.
So that's what the non-square thing, right? So the
No, sorry. Okay, this is more confusing than then it would have taken me to write the whole thing. So let me just write the whole thing. So this is also known as 1 over r squared sine squared theta d phi squared minus 1 over r squared sine theta d theta sine theta d phi, which combines this term and that term. And then there is a piece that's minus 1 over r squared dr r squared g 0 0 dr. And this is all acting on phi of r vector t.
The second dp is a d phi, right?
Oh, and I forgot a d phi.
Yeah, but it's like it says d theta sine theta d theta.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, but where is the d phi though?
D phi is here.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Yep. Okay. So let me just look at the time court. So this is, now let's look at the non-relativistic expansion and first think about the time coordinate. So let's just look at the piece of this. Oh, sorry, this was not supposed to be equal to zero. This is equal to minus mu squared phi. You guys are losing the game at catching my mistakes. Had to pay attention. Okay. So let's look at the time-dependent components. So if I apply dt squared to this field, there'll be two terms, one that's proportional to e to the minus I mu t, and one that's proportional to e to the I mu t. And they have to independently satisfy this equation because they have different time dependencies. So let's just look at one of them. So let's look at, so this gives, let's look at the e to the minus I mu t piece. Psi of, now it's psi not phi of r and t. So this looks like e to the minus I mu t minus I mu squared when both of the time derivatives hit the exponent. And then it looks like minus 1 minus I mu twice with psi dot when one of the derivative hits this and one the other hits this. And then we get a plus psi double dot. So, but remember that we were saying that psi is slowly varying. So let's just drop the higher derivative terms. And let's just look at the first two. And these will turn out to be important. Now, if you look at the full equation, what you get is an equation for psi. And the psi equation, the leading terms proportional to mu squared are going to cancel from the time derivative. So you have dt squared plus mu squared minus this grad squared on phi. I'm plugging in what we got for the dt squared there is e to the minus I mu t normalized minus mu squared minus I mu, minus mu squared psi, excuse me, there should be a psi here, minus I mu psi dot, and then I'm dropping the next piece. There's a plus mu squared just from the Klein-Gordon equation, psi, and then minus grad squared psi. Okay? Oops.
This looks like psi mu psi dot.
This is psi dot, and everything else is a psi.
Yeah, no, I don't mean two dots. I mean there's a, it's a two I mean, right?
Two, yes, thank you. There's a two, great. Okay, and this whole thing is supposed to equal zero, and this is all very nice because what we find, excuse me. So I want to keep this 1 minus 1 plus 2 RG over R term here. So you see now I have two small parameters. One is RG over R. And the other one is the time dependence and the momenta of psi. So I'm only going to keep first order in both. So that's why I kind of neglected the RG over R in the spatial derivative, because we'll both be hitting psi with a spatial derivative, which gives slow momentum, small momenta. And so we're only going to care about the leading piece from the metric. But for the time, there's a piece that has a mu squared. So that one is big compared to all the other things. So we're going to keep that one. So this gives how do I write this? So this minus mu squared, sorry for my slightly confusing board work. So I'm just going to keep this, but only in front of the minus mu squared. Is everyone still on board? Okay, so now I'm getting to the punchline, which is that let me just write that out again. So we get minus mu squared psi, which cancels with a plus mu squared psi. And then we get minus 2rg over r mu squared psi minus 2i mu psi dot plus minus grad squared psi equals 0. And hopefully this is starting to look familiar. If we divide through by minus 2 mu, we get psi dot I psi dot equals minus grad squared over 2 mu psi minus mu rg over r psi. So I canceled this mu and this 2, and I got an over 2 mu here. So that's good. So does this remind you of something? Yay, we got there. Okay, so this is the hydrogen atom with alpha, which is usually the defined structure constant, is equal to mu times rg, which makes sense because it's also just g Newton m mu, so it's the gravitational coupling between the scalar and the black hole. And you can think of it as the ratio between the black hole size and the Compton wavelength of the particle. So now let's do a few facts about gravitational atoms. Let's take some numerical examples. So let's take, I think I did a 10 solar mass black hole. RG is equal to 15 kilometers. And this is also known as, in the units where C equals 1, 0.05 milliseconds. So it takes light that much time to cross a black hole. The next interesting quantity, so let's fix alpha, is 0.1, just to have a number. So we have mu inverse is 150 kilometers, or also known as 0.5 milliseconds. That's the Compton wavelength of the particle. The Bohr radius, do you guys remember what the Bohr radius is of a hydrogen atom? Yes, and what is that in terms of things like alpha and the electron mass? So the Bohr radius is 1 over alpha times the electron mass, which you can get roughly from equating the kinetic and the potential energies of the electron. So if we, instead of the electron mass, we take the particle mass, then this is Rg over alpha squared, right? Because we have 1 alpha here, and then we plug in a 1 over mu, which is Rg over alpha. So the cloud size is going to be 1,500 kilometers in size. So this is good. So we want the small alpha expansion because what we were starting with is two small parameters, right? The radius where most of the scalar field lives is much larger than the black hole. So this is good. And also the energy is small compared, the binding energy is small compared to the mass. So let's do energy is of order, do you remember the Bohr energy of the hydrogen atom? 13.6. Oh, 13.6 eV, that's very good. No, again, in fundamental units. What happens if I change alpha, then you don't know it. Okay, so this is this is alpha squared over 2 n squared me. So if you plug that in, me is 0.5 mega electron volts. Alpha is 1 over 137 in electromagnetism. So then eventually you'll get 13.6 eV out of that. Okay, so and that so that again, this is the same, except now we put a mu here. So if alpha is small, then these energies are much smaller compared to the mass. So we were also good in our non-relativistic approximation. Okay, so now what do we do? Well, we want to create these bound states super radiantly.
There's no n level here. Oh, there he is, sorry.
Oh, yes. So the solutions, good. The solutions to a hydrogen atom are characterized by three quantum numbers, the principal quantum number n, and the angular quantum numbers L and M. And M is going to be the same M that we have here. Okay. Yes.
So maybe this is naive, but what happens if the field is massless?
No, that's not naive. The field is massless means that the field will not have any bound states. Yeah. So you can still interact with the black hole, but there's not going to be any stable bound orbits. Yeah. That's a good question. Okay. So let me see. So I wanted to go through with you in estimating the super radiance time scale of these atomic systems. And I can do that a bit quickly. So here we have our field, and let me just write psi. So the solutions, as I said, for the gravitational atom are of the form, so they're normalized. Let me just write a squiggle here. It's very approximate. So they're normalized to the, let me call it RC because that's what was over there. They're normalized to the cloud radius or the Bohr radius. So when you integrate over volume, you get a unit probability. And then you have R over RC to the 2L e to the minus R over RC and YLM of theta and phi. And then there's some Legendre polynomials and stuff, but this is the important behavior. So you have polynomial growth as you go to from zero to the cloud size, and then it dies off exponentially. And the higher the angular momentum is of the mode, the smaller is the value at the horizon or at the origin because of the angular momentum barrier. You don't have, the cloud wants to sit further away from the center because of the angular momentum barrier, which is seen here. So even though if you wanted to properly solve the scalar field on the Kerr background, what you do is you do this limit at large radii. Now you'd also do the solution at smaller radii, which is even nastier than this. And then you try to match them together. And then you'd see that there's a imaginary piece that appears in the energies because of the dissipation of the horizon. But we can just do that quickly. Let's say, what is the flux of the scalar field at the horizon? Okay? So we take some, this is the probability amplitude of the scalar field, and let's just see what it is on the horizon of the black hole. So if I plug in this whole thing, I get that the absorption of a, say, Schwarzschild black hole of this field goes as 1 over RC cubed, R over RC, R plus, or RG, because I'm plugging in R as being at the black hole horizon, to the 4L. And then we don't care about the rest because that's important at large radii. And times the area of the black hole, which is roughly RG squared. And is there, let me write it along with my time scales here. So gamma, if we plug in these RCs from over there, we get gamma is, so it's 1 over RC cubed, R over RC to the 4L, RG squared. So we get a bunch of factors of alpha here because RC is RG over alpha squared. And if you do this out carefully, you'll get that it's alpha to the 6 plus 4L times 1 over RG. And this turns out to actually be a great approximation to the super radiance rate. In particular, if we remember, before we had a rate of scalar fields that were being absorbed. And remember, we did a substitute where we took a 1 here and we turned it into a 1 minus omega m over omega, where m or omega was the angular velocity of the rotating object. So if we do the same trick, and this is an absorption rate, so let me put minus signs here, then this gives you the rate at which scalar fields around black holes in these bound orbits grow or decay just because of the rotational motion of the black hole. So there's many order one coefficients and some other things, but this gives you the important scaling. And that's just taking this solution of the scalar field of a gravitational atom and seeing what its absorption probability is onto a black hole at the center. And then doing this trick of making the black hole rotate at frequency omega, which we derived up there. So that will bring me to showing you some pretty pictures. So I'll need the screen for that, please. Thank you. This is magical. This place is magical. OK. in the meantime, do you guys have any questions? Hopefully you can still see some things. So you can see the angular velocity, and you can see these time scales. OK? Yes, question.
If the black hole is rotating, can you get any bound states for massless particles?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, that's still the same. Yeah. You can get, you can get orbits. I mean, this is true for regular black holes, too. You can get orbits that are that go around on a circle, but they're not stable. OK. Other questions? And I just want to note that the super radiance rate that we derived over here, let me just write it again as a time scale. So T super radiance is RG over alpha to the 6 plus 4L 1 minus omega mu over m inverse. So you can see that there's just really two scales in the problem. There's the size of the black hole, and then there's the small coupling factor alpha. So the super radiance time will always be slow compared to, say, the light crossing time of the black hole or the Compton wavelength of the particle. But it's still parametrically the same. And for low L, say if L is 1, this is alpha to the 10. So if you plug this in, I think you get something like the rate being order 10 to the 5 seconds for these parameters. So that's about a day. So even though it's much slower than all these other timescales, a day is still very fast in terms of astrophysics, in terms of evolution of black holes, their accretion, and so on. It's not showing up on the screen. Hello?
I don't think you've plugged in yet.
Oh, thanks.
It's not that magical.
Yeah. Yeah, and my computer doesn't magically plug in. OK, hopefully this works. Yes, excellent. Good. OK. So first, I want to show you, let's see if this works. So this is a calculation that's done by Will East here to show you that I'm not making stuff up, and black holes really amplify and scatter waves. So Will East is a professor here who does lots of very nice GR simulations. So this is a black hole at the center, and you'll see an incoming gravitational wave, the blue. And then it'll rescatter from the black hole as a red gravitational wave, which has much larger amplitude. So this is the full general relativistic calculation. And you can see the growth is really quite big. And it turns out for spin 2 fields, that's the biggest super radiant growth that you can get. Scalar fields are not quite as efficient. OK, so let's go through a short story of super radiance, and then I'll conclude with the signatures. So we've talked a lot about all the different parameters in detail, so hopefully now it'll come together. We have black hole mass here on the x-axis in solar masses. And the black hole spin from 0, which is Schwarzschild, so 1, which is extremal Kerr, as we've defined before. And here are the superradiance condition lines. So here's where this factor, the superradiance factor is zero for different gravitational bound states. So for different M numbers. So we take a black hole angular horizon velocity, and we compare it to omega over M for different M, and that gives us these different lines. And if the black hole is spinning faster than that, it has bigger A star, so it has bigger angular velocity, then superradiance can happen. So let's see what happens. We start with a black hole that's born with a high spin, say 0.95 and some supernova. In about 10 years, for the parameters that I've picked, the black hole goes down. It loses its angular momentum and a little bit of its mass to a scalar field that grows around it in the 2p level. So a level with angular momentum 1 and principle number 2. So that turns out to be the fastest growing level here because it's the closest to the black hole. And for the parameters that I've picked here, the scalar mass is 6 times 10 to minus 13 eV, which I should say, I think here I was picking parameters. This is also known as 1 over 10 to the minus 12 electron volts,
so
if you want to compare numbers.
What are the shaded versions? Can you explain again the figure?
Yeah, the shaded regions are the ones where the superradiance condition is satisfied for the parameters that I've chosen. So I've picked one mass for the scalar field, and then I want to compare that mass over m to the angular velocity, which just gives you the phase velocity of the field, to the angular velocity of the black hole. And depending if I choose angular momentum 1, 2, 3, that gives us the different three different regions. So if it's blue, that means the superradiance condition is satisfied, so you get growth of the scalar field. So here you have a black hole that spins down. You can understand that because the field is growing. In fact, it's growing exponentially at the superradiance rate. And that energy is coming from somewhere, which is coming from the black hole losing its angular momentum and mass. On this line, as I was saying, the superradiance condition is no longer satisfied, so the phase velocities are exactly matching. The phase velocity of the field is exactly matching the velocity of the black hole horizon. So at this point, superradiance stops, and we have 10 to the 77 particles in the cloud. Where's the 10 to the 77 come from? That's me calculating the angular momentum of the black hole, which if you remember is A star times RG times the mass, in fundamental units. So let's do a 10 solar mass black hole, has angular momentum L is A star RG M, almost by definition of A star, which is also known as A star G Newton M squared. For a 10 solar mass black hole, this is roughly 10 to the 77 for A star, I think, of 0.1. So remember, angular momentum doesn't have any dimensions. So this is, or it has dimensions of H bar. So a 10 solar mass black hole roughly carries 10 to the 77 units of H bar, and each axion, each unit of the scalar field steals one h-bar from the black hole. And eventually it spins down and the process stops. But eventually it actually keeps going because the next further level out can start to grow. Now this, it has a slower phase velocity because m is bigger. So omega over m is smaller. But it also takes much longer because now the level is far away from the black hole. So its absorption onto the black hole is not as efficient. So the growth is actually parametrically slower. So the next jump in parameter space takes about 10 to the 6 years. And in the meantime, the innermost level is actually annihilating to gravitational wave radiation.
So, okay, so this is, you're sourcing this boson.
Yeah.
And, just a single black hole, why does the superradiance happen for the graviton?
That's a good question, exactly, because it's massless.
Yeah.
So as I showed in the first animation, that was superradiance of gravitons, right? That was an ingoing gravitational wave. But for a massless wave, what happens is it scatters once with a black hole, it grows by a few percent, and then it travels off to infinity.
Right.
Here, what we've done is we've taken bound states with the black hole, so it can continuously pump energy into it, and the growth becomes exponential.
Like enhancement, cubic enhancement.
Exactly. It becomes an exponential growth because you have a field that's sitting there.
State, yeah.
Exactly.
So if you were in some IGN and somehow you break the Lorentz invariant, so your graviton is massive. I don't know if it's possible. But.
I think you have to be very careful about making gravitons massive because the whole solution relies on normal GR.
Yes.
You can think about trying to make photons massive, but another thing about superradiance is that you want everything to be dominated by the gravitational interactions of the system, and photons are very strongly interacting with the environment. So you could say you have an effective mass for a photon because it's in a medium or something, but usually that ends badly. So I'm happy to tell you in more detail later.
Do people actually, if you're in the medium, do people actually think the graviton have an effective mass?
I mean, it's very hard for gravitons to get an effective mass. It's forbidden by many symmetries. I'm not going to talk about graviton masses because wrong things.
I'm not saying in the modified gravity or anything. It's just in the medium. I think it will.
No, you'd have to have a medium that violates the symmetries of normal space-time, I guess. Anyway, we can talk about this later. I want to get to the signatures because, you can definitely have medium that breaks Lorentz invariance and gives a photon a mass, for example. But I think gravitons are a bit trickier. Okay. So at the end of this story, this is not going to be affected by superradiance. I mean, that's not true in principle. The next levels out will continue to be populated, but the reasons why these curves turn up is because of that, of this L dependence of the wave function. So the overlap of the wave function with the black hole becomes polynomially suppressed at larger and larger angular momenta. And so eventually, the rates become so slow that they're slower than the age of the universe, for example. And then we don't really care in terms of practical observables. So there's two signatures of this. One is obviously the black holes are spinning down if there's a scalar field in the right mass range. So here I've picked a different mass just to illustrate, a 10 to minus 11 eV, which corresponds to a QCD axion with decay constant of around a little above the gut scale, 10 to the few times 10 to the 17 GeV. So I've drawn the same superradiance curves here, but now we see that there's actual data. And these comes from measurements of black holes in binary systems, which have some information about how quickly the black hole is rotating and how massive it is. So we can plot this data, overlay this data, and what this is saying is that if you have a black hole that's completely within the error bars within the blue region, we know if there was a particle of such a mass in the theory, it would have spun down to the bottom of the blue region. So we can use these measurements to exclude the possibility that these particles exist in the theory. In particular, these two black holes, I think Cygnus X1 and I forget the other one, disfavor this axion mass.
So if this is newly created, why would you expect that?
They're not newly created.
You don't know the age.
Yes, you have to have an estimate for the age of the system, which you can usually get from studying the properties of its companion and seeing that the orbits are stable over long times.
Right.
So they're usually millions of years. But since the superradiance rate is such a fast function of alpha, which is also the mass of the particle, an error in the age of the system is not very important. The spin error is more important than the mass. And as you go to lighter axion masses, that corresponds to bigger black holes if you hold this alpha fixed, right? Because the coupling is the ratio of the black hole size to the Compton wavelength of the particle. So lighter particles means longer Compton wavelengths, means bigger, heavier black holes. So these curves all shift to heavier black holes. So even more of them exclude this lighter axion mass. So we can combine that, all these nice reference numbers of the black holes to exclude roughly a factor of 30 in axion mass, which are very light and also very weakly coupled. As you can tell, the FAA scale for these is up to the Planck scale. So they're extremely difficult to look for in the laboratory because they're so weakly interacting. So this is a really nice way to try to get a handle on these particles.
How do you know that the environment around the black hole doesn't spin it up again?
You don't. You can estimate how fast the black hole can get spun up. And that there's actually a limit on how quickly you can spin up a black hole, because if you try to spin it up by throwing matter into it, eventually it will start radiating, and that radiation pressure will back react on the infalling matter. And so you can do an estimate of what's the limiting rate at which you can try to pump matter into the black hole, and that's given by the Eddington accretion time, which is roughly a few times 10 to the 8 years. The spin can change order 1 in 10 to the 8 years. So that's one of the limits that we take, including what Yudai was asking about, the binary age of the system and also the accretion rate. So we make sure that all of the time scales of the superradiance are faster than the other things that can affect the black hole evolution.
So these black holes are in the binary, but the distance is long enough so you can still use the curved black hole approximation.
Yes, exactly. So you can actually treat the neighboring black hole as a perturbation, and that can lead to things like level mixing.
Right.
But you can estimate how big that effect is, and for all the binaries, it's not important for the parameters I'm choosing here. But yeah, that's a great question.
And if you are forming a very close binary, then can you form different kind of bound states?
It looks like usually once the black hole basically enters the cloud, you have to do time-dependent perturbation theory. It's an interesting question. For example, in LIGO, as the black hole goes through each other, there's not really any interesting parameter space, as far as we can tell, where that happens, because by the time black holes get so close, the cloud will have annihilated away. But if it does get so close, then it can also, now the cloud can be absorbed by one black hole and the other black hole. So most likely it'll also get eaten pretty quickly. That just comes from numbers. I mean, it's not an obvious statement. You have to check what because the state grows and then it decays away into gravitational wave radiation. So the time scale for that is something. And it turns out to be fast enough that usually the states don't stick around. So in the last couple of minutes, I'll just show you. So you can do the same thing for LIGO black holes. So you can do statistics. This is the same picture I was showing you before. If you start with a bunch of fast spinning black holes, what you expect to see is dips in the spin mass plane. So you can try to do statistics once LIGO sees enough black hole mergers where they measure the spins and masses. And right now the resolution is not so good, so you get a picture that looks like this. But with hundreds of black holes, which they should be able to get on tape, you can definitely start to make some statements about whether you see these dips in the black hole spin mass distribution at LIGO as well. So that's kind of complementary or a different way of doing the spin black hole spin measurements. Okay, and then the final thing is the gravitational wave signals. So I didn't have time to tell you about how these happen, but basically, if you take the scalar field solution that we found and you plug it into the stress energy tensor, you'll see that the stress energy tensor has time-dependent components. Alternatively, you can just calculate the quadrupole moment of the cloud and say that it's varying at the frequency that's equal to the mass. And you'll see that it's source of gravitational wave radiation. And what you can estimate, you'll hear about LIGO next week, so you can ask them how good their sensitivities are. But assuming the sensitivities that they've provided, you can estimate how many events you can see. So let me just focus on these guys. So this is, you have this axion cloud, and two of these axions come together and emit gravitational wave radiation. They don't have any conserved quantum numbers, so they're allowed to do that. And since you have this black hole curvature, you can conserve both energy and momentum, because you can get some momentum from the black hole potential. And what we did is we estimated those rates, and we calculated how many black holes we expect in our galaxy to be superradiating today if there was a particle of a given mass. So this is the mass of the particle in EV, and this is the number of detectable sources given some advanced LIGO design sensitivity. So the gray is the already disfavored region from the spin measurements. So we think that there can be as many as thousands of sources, which are just monochromatic gravitational wave radiation that's coming from these super radiating axion clouds. And the gravitational radiation will be at frequencies that's at twice the axion mass. So you'll expect to see these monochromatic lines in the LIGO data, and that's an analysis that's similar to some other ones they're doing, and we're talking to LIGO experimentalists about tailoring it specifically for these super radiant searches. So since we're out of time, and I'm pretty much done, I'll leave you with this another video, which is gravitational wave radiation from, in this case, it's a vector, massive vector field, but it's the same general principle, radiating gravitational waves off to infinity. So there's the little black hole surrounded by a super radiant cloud, and it has some phase that's oscillating at twice at the frequency of the cloud and producing gravitational wave radiation. So I hope I've convinced you that black holes are great detectors for new light particles. Super radiance is a very general kinematic effect, but it's optimized for black holes because they can rotate very fast and they absorb very quickly, which counterintuitively actually gives really fast growth of these scalar bound states around black holes. And you can use this to look for scalars and massive vectors. Massive spin 2 I won't get into because, as I said, it's complicated. But it's a very interesting window into these ultralight particles with wavelengths comparable to black hole sizes. So thanks.